Good afternoon and welcome to Talk of the Towns. We try to go beyond the headlines to make sense of the issues facing Maine communities, to share what works, to seek alternative solutions. Talk of the Towns is aired on WERU Community Radio since 1993, dedicated to the proposition that everyone benefits when we share our knowledge, our experience, our concerns, and our perspectives. We're about to practice the magic of community radio, in which those of us in our virtual studio and you who are listening create a kind of dialogue that we hope will be of benefit to our friends, our neighbors, and colleagues. We are your hosts, Ron Beard and Liz Graves, hoping you'll stay with us for the next hour and Talk of the Towns. And a reminder that we aren't taking calls for the show or recording it in advance. And no joke, a philosopher, a writer, and a scientist walk into a radio show about artificial intelligence. Artificial intelligence, or AI, is already part of our lives. What can we learn about how it might help with collaboration and decision-making, about the creative process, and about its applications in science and medicine? And so we're so happy to have some guests who can help us with that conversation. Gray Cox is a professor of philosophy at College of Atlantic and author of a recent book, Smarter Planet or Wiser Earth: Dialogue and Collaboration in the Era of Artificial Intelligence. Nina Barifaldi St. Germain is a business owner, a writer, and an artist. And Greg DeHennepy is the Senior Director of Computational Sciences at the Jackson Laboratory. Welcome to you all. So glad you could be with us. And I'd like to start and just ask each of you to give a thumbnail sketch of who you are and how you kind of come to understand AI in your lives. Gray Cox and I taught a course a number of years ago at the Acadia Senior College about the topic. So, Gray, I know you've been thinking about this for some while. Give us a little bit of background on yourself, if you would, please.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me to this conversation. I'm looking forward to it. I about 20 years ago, read a book by Ray Kurzweil called The Singularity is Near. And it persuaded me that actually AI wasn't just a topic of philosophical interest, but that it was going to be increasingly important, transformative technology in our lives. And so I started to study it in more depth. And I grew up in Bar Harbor, and so I was connected with College Atlantic since I was a guinea pig student in the first program they had in 1971. And so I was bringing a kind of a human ecological interest to this. How is AI going to affect various life systems that we have, and how can we understand that in an interdisciplinary kind of holistic way? And when I was in graduate school in Tennessee, started going to Quaker meetings and immediately felt home. And their approaches that Quakers have to dialogue that seemed to me really important, the way I think about what it is to be human and to connect with other folks. And so I was really concerned about how AI might enable or disable kinds of really human dialogue. And I also was looking a lot at questions about peace and what it would be like to have a culture of peace. And so questions about how AI might affect that through lethal autonomous weapons or through ways in which it, through social media, it might accentuate kinds of verbal violence between people and how we might counter that. All those kinds of questions interested me. And I expect we'll get into some of those kinds of things today.
Great. And I'll ask you in a moment what your understanding of AI is. I'll ask each of you that. But let's go to Nina Barifaldi St. Germain. You just got your MFA at the University of Southern Maine as a writer and an artist. But tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, thanks, Ron. I think first and foremost, I'm a mom, and then I'm a business owner, and then I'm a writer slash artist in that, probably in that order. And I think I first encountered AI, I think I'll speak really practically first. I won't get so philosophical. My son was at a pretty fancy private school, and I got a 2-page response from one of his teachers. And I was like, wow, this is amazing. This is so comprehensive and like so thoughtful about my child, right? So I was feeling really, I don't know, I just felt really indulged by the amount of time that it must have taken to complete this response. And then I went in for the parent meeting and he said, oh, I've been using ChatGPT. He's like, do you have any idea how much time it saves me? And I was like, oh. And so suddenly it went from being a very meaningful document to being completely unmeaningful in my eye. And so I was playing with that. And then with my 12-year-old, he asked me to watch South Park. We watched South Park. And it was the Trey Parker did a collaboration with ChatGPT. It was the deep learning episode. And it was so funny and very real. And I connected very much to the content that was in the South Park episode. And so I was like having some cognitive dissonance, like, why do I dislike it over here? And why do I appreciate it over here? So I think that was really what prompted my research into AI.
Great, thanks. And Greg, glad you could join us from the Jackson Lab. Tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and how you kind of came to be interested in AI.
Thanks, Ron. It's great to be here with all of you. I've been 30 years at Jax this month. I've been a technology person in my entire career at Jax, and from before that, although I do have a BA in philosophy, and grew up with a father who was a philosopher. And so I've come have a bit of that in my background. Technology at Jax has included AI for quite a while, as you might not be surprised to hear. I did get to see Ray Kurzweil speak in person not long after his book came out in Boston. And so that might have been one of my earlier exposures to AI. And at that time, the things he said were, it's so implausible, frankly. I came away from that presentation just thinking, oh my goodness, you know, this is crazy. Because I was in an audience full of scientists and technology people. At Jax, we've been working with AI for quite some time, although not large language models per se, the more traditional neural networks, et cetera. So very, very much applied, but more recently have been playing quite a lot with large language models and learning how to apply them to some of the things we do at Jax, and also just experimenting. One of the things I've had a lot of fun with is instead of asking questions of large language models, getting them to ask the questions. So I'll actually take two of them and I'll ask one of them, what questions you have on this topic? And then I'll give them to the other LLM and give the answers, and I'll have them go back and forth and have a conversation. And that's had some interesting outcomes. Hmm. So we're very actively, working in this field. In fact, I have a call at, coming up a little bit later that is about using LLMs to try and identify optimal growth mediums for breast tumor tissues. So that's very much very active. It'll be three calls this morning about AI.
Well, thank you, everybody. Hi, this is Liz. You haven't heard my voice yet. I'm super excited to be together. And I think maybe for my first question, I'm going to go right back to Greg, since you're the technical guy. If you would help us understand sort of standard definitions, and actually now I have three things since we've already mentioned them. What is artificial intelligence, commonly understood? What is a large language model, and what is a neural network? And if you think there are any other subtypes, without going too far into the weeds, that would help us frame. And then we're also going to ask Nina and Gray for their own working definitions, because I think they might be slightly different. So, Greg.
Great. I'll do my best here because I am not, my background's technology, but we have a lot of folks at Jax whose PhDs are in AI, and I'm not one of those people, but I do know enough about some of this material. The world of AI, typically, if you look at a formal definition, it's about giving the ability of some kind of system to gather information about its environment and then learn about that and then pursue some goal. Typically, one of the things that sets apart, at least in my mind, artificial intelligence from other computer systems is that it's not necessarily an algorithm that simply does something very rule-based, technically. I mean, I think of traffic lights. A traffic light comes on, it's on for 30 minutes then or 30 seconds, switches to the other, and it's programmed to do a certain activity. Whereas AI tends to observe or gather information about an environment and then have some goal. So if you apply AI to the stoplight example, the AI would perhaps attempt to optimize traffic flow through that stoplight and adjust as traffic was changing. So, you know, in a way, that's, I guess, a somewhat simplistic view of the differences between sort of traditional computer systems and what people tend to think of as AI. Large language models are a specific form of neural networks that have trained on massive bodies of information and have come to understand the statistical relationships between the positions of words and the structure of sentences, basically, at least the ones like ChatGPT, et cetera. And so what they're doing is they're just, looking at a large context. The bigger the window that they're looking at, the better. And they're saying, what's the next word that's going to come here? You know, so that's at the end of the day, they're really just predicting the next word. They don't understand what the content is. They just are predicting the next word or series of words. So that's, you know, a great example of why they don't understand is called the Alice in Wonderland problem. If you ask ChatGPT, Mary has two sisters and one brother, how many sisters does Mary's brothers have? It will not answer correctly. It cannot figure that out. So it doesn't understand those concepts, but it can put the, and it'll even give you the reasoning and still give you the wrong answer.
A large language model is a subset of a broader thingy called a neural network. And super briefly, what's a neural network?
These are neural networks take, again, lots of information. They look at the relationships between large amounts of data and understand the relationships between those data. You know, classic applications of them, for example, are in image analysis. And this is something we do at JAX a lot. We take images of somebody's kidney with kidney disease, and you train the model. You say, here are healthy kidneys, here are diseased kidneys, and you train the model. And then you give it a new image and go, which one is this? Is it diseased or healthy? Right. And so it's a classifier. They tend to classify things into clusters of things. And you can train those, or you can do zero shot where you just give them all the data and let it figure out what the differences are. But so that's a quick version of neural.
Awesome. Thank you. I'm going to go to Gray next because it teed up nicely some of how you introduce in your book one of the things that AI is created or programmed to meet. Goals is one word, or you also use the word values to further sets of values. So
it's striking that over the last 50, 60, 70 years now, really, people have used the term AI to refer to different things. It sort of shifts as the technology develops. And so now, Greg is absolutely right. I think that the focus is on large language models and what they call generative AI that can do similar things with visual and audio images and so on. Because the technology is going to keep on changing, it's really helpful to start with a very broad definition and then make distinctions within it. And I would start by defining intelligence. And I would define it as the ability to realize or sustain or enhance some value, where the idea is that if you don't have any value in the very broad sense, a goal, preference, whatever, if you don't have any preference or goal or value, then whatever happens, you're indifferent to it. There's no right or wrong answer. So it's only once you have values that you have an intelligence. And once you do, the ability to get to the right answer better is sort of in general what we mean by intelligence. And that definition is broad enough so that it actually includes animals and plants that, you know, are valuing things like sunlight and successful reproduction and so on. And it includes very simple forms of machine behavior like a thermostat electronically that maintains the value of a certain temperature in your household. So given that very broad definition, then, you know, artificial intelligence is the kind that uses machines to do this kind of stuff. And within it, I think the distinction that Greg's remarks were making is important to highlight. There are sort of two kinds of reasoning that can be useful to distinguish. One is what we might call linear inference. It's the kind of reasoning that comes down from Aristotle, Euclidean geometry, Newtonian physics, and so on, are based on where you start with a set of assumptions or premises, and then you use algorithmic rules to arrive at a conclusion. And it's the kind of thing that one person can do. Once you know the assumptions, the data, and you know the rules, you can generate the output. And similarly, one machine can do that. So in that sense, it's a kind of monological reasoning. But there's a, and it's associated with what's sometimes called good old-fashioned AI, the traditional image of the kind of AI that beat Garry Kasparov in chess. He was the world champion until 1997 or so. But there's a second kind of reasoning that we do in everyday life a lot to deal with ethical issues and all sorts of concerns. And it's dialogical, where you have two or more people with different points of view, different ways of defining terms, different assumptions. And the process of reasoning is one where they try to find common meanings they can agree on, find common ground they can assume, and find some way to arrive at an agreement. And that kind of reasoning is not algorithmic. It typically has guidelines like, you know, when you have a dilemma, look for a third alternative. But unlike traditional logical algorithms, it doesn't tell you what the third alternative is. So I think one of the key things about the new kind of evolutionary programs that use neural nets and so on and can evolve through training is that they're making it possible to begin to think about how we could include dialogical reasoning in AI and include AI in our life systems and the way we run our schools, the way we run our food systems and so on in dialogical ways so that we can have all the voices of the community attended to and taken into account in a wiser way.
Thank you. I'm so glad you said that last thing because I underlined it in the introduction to the book and I wanted to ask you about it. So we're already there. That's great. Okay. And I have an image that I don't know if it'll be helpful, but I'm going to offer it anyway, that in a real world thing, we just talked about an algorithm, what an algorithm does. As you spoke, I remembered I had a very clear memory from undergraduate algebra. My degree is in math. And I loved the way that the algorithms I was applying on the beloved 100-year-old slate chalkboards at Vassar, as I worked through the proofs that I was doing, the problems that I was doing, each step was super simple. I didn't have to decide how to apply it, which one to apply. I mean, it was very straightforward, very monological. And I would sit there and look at my work after a while and think, gosh, this is like knitting. And so it's relaxing to me in the way that knitting is to others. And said, so you actually, I think, Gray, early in the book, have an image of a loom and how mm-hmm. these algorithmic processes are what we built simple machines to be able to do. A fun connection. So thank you for indulging me. Nina, yeah. what is your definition of artificial intelligence?
Mine is much more simple. I go to the library a lot. Laura Edwards is like at the Jessup is my favorite. She's like up until AI, she was the best librarian I had ever met. And so for me, AI is kind of like the best librarian. It's when I want to do something, it's the tool that I can use to get me where I want to go. For other people, I describe it as a non-emotional brain that's trained like ours on the compendium of digital information. But that's how I've explained it to people because I think that's really accessible.
And Nina, how have you used it in your perhaps in your MFA process of pursuing a degree?
Oh, okay. So I've used it in many different ways. So first and foremost, I'm dyslexic. So I started out with the really simple AIs that were telling me I had reversals, like the basic computer programs that would check your grammar and things like that. Not necessarily AI, but, you know, it had me indoctrinated into thinking that a computer could help me get what I wanted to say out into the world in a way that was easily consumed. Because if you have reversals and things like that, people will instantly discount your language. Mm-hmm. And so it was, for me, it was a huge win because I wasn't having those simple mistakes in what I was putting out in the world. So that was kind of how I became maybe an adopter. And then I have some oppositional defiance as well. So as soon as the kind of the literary world came out and said, AI is terrible, this is going to ruin the world, I was like, let's check this out, because that's maybe just my personality. So I've used it in a number of ways. For business, I've made web scrapers to help me find out what people are charging for steak dinners, what people are charging for hotel rooms, so I can find out if my business is keeping up with other businesses in terms of rates. But basically, it just walked me through the computer program. I set it up. Yeah. Now I just hit run and it populates everything I want to see. So that was pretty cool. I spent about a day doing that. But specifically with my writing, I have used it as an editor. So I will take my work, I will plug in my original work, and I will ask it maybe for an outline. Or I will ask it, have I fleshed out this idea? And it will give me a response. I have used it in role playing. So I basically trained it to be one of my characters. In writing, you're always trying to figure out, like, what does your character want? Right? That's like the big question when you're writing. What does your character want? And if you don't have those wants clearly delineated, then your story kind of falls apart because there's no tension. And so you can train this character, you can train the AI, you say, we're going to role play, you're going to be this character. And you tell it all about itself. It was, you know, born by the Mississippi. It was, you know, it had any number of different character attributes that we might have. And then you say, and then you have a conversation and you kind of find out what's unique about a person in this situation. I had an argument with a family member and I actually trained it to be my family member, which I know sounds really creepy and like surreal, but at the same time, it was actually a really useful exercise for me because I was able to, in a non-emotional way, inhabit another perspective. So that was a pretty cool thing that I've done in terms of how I used it, how I use it, and then also brainstorming. And one of the ways that I use it for brainstorming that I was taught by another author named Henry Lean is you do your brainstorming, you get to a plot point, you're wondering, hey, where do I go from here? You create the prompt, you say you get 10 results, you read the 10 results, and then you erase them. And so the idea being that you've had the ideas, the information has come to you, but then we don't rely on it to continue with the writing. And that, I believe, is one of the best ways to maintain agency as a writer while using AI.
I just want to remind listeners that they're tuned to Talk of the Towns. We're having a conversation about artificial intelligence in our lives. We're joined by Nina Barafaldi St. Germain, who's a business owner, a writer, an artist, also by Gray Cox, who's a professor of philosophy at College of Atlantic in Bar Harbor, who written a book called Smarter Planet, Wiser Earth, and by Greg DeHennepy, senior director of computational sciences at the Jackson Lab. Gray, how have you made use of AI in your life, your life as a professor or your life as a parent or as a community member?
I've been using AI, the ChatGPT kinds of things since they came out a year and a half ago in my teaching, been encouraging students to experiment with it, coaching them on how to do prompts and in the research projects that they're doing in a variety of ways. I teach a course on strategies for social change, where people were using it to sort of look at different kinds of strategies, critique their own documents and so on. Then also, I do a course on learning languages on your own. And so people can actually ask the large language model to speak in Spanish or Italian or some other language and interact with it and do role playing and have some experiences of immersion and work on specific skills and topic areas that they're interested in. It's also fun to sort of explore the ways in which the systems hallucinate and have problems. And that's part of the teaching process, learning to wrestle with this new technology. And the sort of the ground rules and the realities of the technology are changing, I mean, really rapidly. Sort of every week for the last year and a half, I've sort of had my mind blown by different stuff. And so it's a lot to keep up with. It's shifted my teaching style. It was already pretty teacher, student, teacher out of the sort of Paulo Freire tradition, but or working with a technology like this, you have to go into the class saying, what are we going to teach each other today? Because otherwise you're going to fall on your face. So I've been using it a lot in my own research because I'm interested in AI and write this book on it, now trying to think about how to apply that in different contexts. And so I'll use it directly in the way, some of the ways that Greg was sort of talking about earlier. You know, you can ask it questions and use it to explore philosophical issues. And I've been trying to test its limits. One of the recent things that I wrote for Colby has a really interesting, important center on AI now, the Colby Davis Center. And they started a journal on writing with AI. I wrote an article for that. And as part of that, sort of was experimenting with whether or not AI is just auto-completion on steroids, as people put it, where it just predicts the next word. And it turns out that actually it's at least in some important respects, is doing something more complicated than that, because in predicting what the next word is going to be, it also is predicting what the last word is going to be. If you ask it to write a 600-word op-ed on why we should be afraid or should not be afraid of AI in the future, to figure out how it's going to start it, it has to figure out, well, where does it want to end? And so it's going to have at the end some sentence that starts like, in conclusion, therefore, for the above reasons, we can, something like that. And that means that in the middle, it's going to have some paragraphs that say something like, you know, a third reason why. Or so it's getting these kinds of structures that influence its beginning. And then, and even, it, you know, if you ask it to write an op-ed, obviously it's not using the same concepts we are, and it's not understanding in the way that we do. But it has sort of mathematical constructs that correspond to the notion of sentence, paragraph, and so on. And it's going to predict that the first sentence, there's a good probability it might start with a question mark, because that's a good way to grab people's interest in an op-ed. And once it's predicted that the first sentence ends with a question mark, then it becomes very probable that the first word is going to be who, what, when, where, why, or how, right? So there's this sort of teleological, purposive structure that's emergent in it. It doesn't, when it says clarinet, the sound of a clarinet, it's never heard a clarinet. It doesn't understand that phrase the way we do. And there are all sorts of ways in which it's different from us in that it's not a social agent that's held accountable, in the way that Nina's student's teacher, I'm sure, was a little bit after exposing her to the reality behind the thing. But it's on the way, I guess, is what I would say. So I'm really interested in exploring those kinds of things. And then there are other areas like bioacoustics. There's amazing work it's been doing in that. Maybe we'll get to some of these other things later.
Greg, again, as the person at the Jackson Lab, we think about medicine, science, and that sort of thing. How would you kind of describe some of the ways in which the Jackson Lab and some of your colleagues are using AI?
Yeah, so we've been using AI for quite some time now, 10, 15 years. And it's typically not the large language model for, really that just came around, as Greg mentioned too, relatively recently. But it's been mostly in the space of understanding and predicting classifying data. So whether it's images of, various parts of the body, in our case, mice, in some cases, Alzheimer's. We had one project that was analyzing MRIs of Alzheimer's patients to see if AI could figure out, could do early predictions of when someone might be developing Alzheimer's, for example. Another example would be using AI in the context of breast cancer and looking at the genetic expression of specific tumors to try and understand if AI can predict the ideal immunotherapy for that particular patient. And that work's been fairly successful and is continuing on. So there's many, many, many examples in that kind of a space. More recently, we've been working with large language models. We have a team that's been exploring the use of them to try and figure out and prioritize gene sets in the context of immunology. So they'll try to, and this is where they're using three or four of these models at once, and they'll get predictions from one and then test those predictions against another and work to try and develop a particular repertoire of genes that might be of relevant to a given area of research. And the call I'm going to have it later this morning is about using large language models to try and identify optimal cultures for tissues, that kind of thing. So those are some of the examples in the scientific realm. We're also using it for things you would probably expect, writing and editing. Writing is a little tougher for me, at least my experience hasn't. It's good to get something started, but often, as everybody who's used it probably has experienced, it's pretty generic. It's like the first pass stuff isn't typically so great. Editing has been quite good, though. I've had a case where I've got a 1,000-word document and I need to get it to 400 words. Not only does it do that, it also tends to restructure things in a pretty effective way. I mean, it's a pretty good edit when it comes to restructuring your arguments and help you think about how you're presenting. I've had some interesting experiences writing and having it sort of be a comment on higher level elements. Like you're writing this particular piece tends, you talk about yourself a lot. Are you considering your audience? You know, that kind of thing. I've used it a little bit for image generation. I would love to play with that more. I'm an amateur photographer and would really be interested in doing more of that, but I haven't had time. The thing I've used it for most though, personally, has been just learning things. In fact, with the latest version of ChatGPT, I've come to, I'll stick it on my dashboard and just have a conversation with it while I'm driving. I had to drive to Bangor the other day, so I figured I think I'm going to learn about zinc finger proteins. So, it's a very interesting way to learn about a topic. You do have to be cautious and check. And, the issue around the generative component, and Gray talked about this, in terms of it is predicting the next word in a sentence, but it's bigger than that. And so there is a potential there. And this is one of the reasons I've been doing them playing against each other, that it can synthesize something potentially novel across a body of knowledge. So you might take, it might take ideas from a dozen different scientific papers and propose something that might be, I don't have a good example of this yet, but it seems like it may be feasible to get new ideas in some cases because of its generative capability. So I don't know, that's an area still being explored.
I can imagine that listeners to Talk of the Towns are beginning to say, but what about the dangers of AI? Because we've all heard about those. So again, not to go in very deeply, but if we could talk about some of the concerns that you're aware of, again, maybe starting with Greg and how we address those things so that we can kind of put those to the side and then come back to how can we use AI in the future. Greg, what are some of the concerns that you're aware of or have heard about?
So at JAX, the primary concern, starting a year ago, not long after ChatGPT came out, was actually mostly around intellectual property. Mm-hmm. You would put your ideas into the system and they became part of the training and incorporated into the system. Now, most of those issues have been addressed in the intervening time. And we've also gotten, we've paid for access to models that are protected. So any data we enter does not go anywhere else, does not train anyone else's models. And they almost all now have a switch you can throw to say, don't learn from this conversation. But that certainly is one of the concerns. So that's one. Another is that we've at JAX, again, there's a great deal of skepticism, you might imagine, from the scientific side about the hallucination problem. So again, it will synthesize things, including PubMed IDs and citations. And so you ask it, I'll say, tell me about this particular zinc finger proteins and please give me five, things to go read. You have to go actually validate that those are real papers. It will sometimes just completely hallucinate the title, the authors, the PubMed ID, everything. So that's a real problem. It's getting better. The systems are getting better. And there are ways to do what's called retrieval augmented generation, where you take a large language model and connect it to an authoritative source of information so that when it does cite a paper, it's actually citing a known actual paper with a proper source. Mm-hmm. And then lastly, I guess, bias. There's another problem with the training data for these systems are not unbiased. And so there's concerns. And this is a problem in the space anyways. For example, most of the genomic data out there is biased towards European populations. So there's issues like that. But so those are the ones that come to mind for me quickly at JAX.
Gray, you've been looking at AI for a long time, and you mentioned the author who wrote about the singularity. What are some of the concerns that you're aware of, and are they being addressed?
Well, so I would divide them into sort of two broad categories. And one is the sort of concern that got me started, which was with Kurzweil's book, which is sometimes referred to as the friendly AI problem or the alignment problem. Are the values of the AI aligned with humans? And the concern is that if we create a system that becomes as smart as humans and can learn how to learn, is it going to just keep going and become dramatically smarter than us to the point where our relationship of our intelligence to it is a little bit like the relationship of the intelligence of the mice at the lab to the scientists at the lab. I mean, that's the sort of concern. If so, will it be friendly to us? Because it'll have a lot of power. There are two wrinkles to that that I think are really important that people have not been paying much attention to that I work on in my book. One is, it's not just that we want it to be friendly to its creator or owner. Because what if that turns out to be a rogue nation or a ruthless capitalist corporation? We want it, in some sense, to be friendly to the good, to a just, democratic, egalitarian, ecologically resilient kind of world, right? So that's one wrinkle. But then the second wrinkle is, suppose that we actually do create an AI, super intelligent, and that really is friendly to the good in that sense. What's it going to make of human beings? What's it going to make of us? I mean, we've created an economy that is creating the sixth great extinction and extraordinarily disruptive climate change. And we run our world, using a system of sort of where the ultimate umpire is nuclear weapons and mutually assured destruction. So, how can we make sure that we would merit its friendship, sort of, right? And I think that's an important issue to think about seriously. And now that we're in the age where we have these AI that we're sort of training and raising and educating through dialogue like children, you have to remember that, to raise an ethical child, it takes an ethical village. So that's one set of problems. What's the structure of the corporations that are making these things? What's the structure of our society's laws and stuff that influence it? Well, so I started worrying about that kind of stuff. And then along the way, I thought, maybe this is exaggerated. Maybe super AI won't come, so what's to worry about? And then I started to realize, actually, the AI that we already have, using the broad sense of the term that I introduced earlier, is already creating enormous problems. And the way I would characterize them is to talk about this vision that IBM had a whole advertising campaign built around it earlier, about 15 years ago. The smarter planet. That's the vision of the future. Smart phones, smart cars, smart schools, smart farms, smarter battlefields, smart bombs, right? The thing about that vision is that it draws on this idea that you have, one or a few goals: maximizing profit for a corporation, test scores in a school, production of soybeans per hectare on a farm, and use monological reasoning to compute, how you can most efficiently realize that goal or one or a few goals. And the problem is that, farms and schools, they serve all kinds of other functions besides producing soybeans or raising test scores. I mean, schools are places where kids can develop character, where they find friendships, where they it's safe places for them to be when their parents are working, where communities can have a sense of cultural identity and living into the future through their kids. Farms provide all kinds of ecological services that give us the oxygen we breathe and the water we drink and so on. So these AI systems are creating all sorts of environmental, social, ecological problems. And what we need are not just smarter systems, but wiser systems, ones that take into account all the relevant values in a balanced way. That's what I would mean in basic sense by wisdom. Take all the relevant values into account in a balanced way, and that which requires a kind of dialogical reasoning, because those values are going to come from different points of view and defined in different ways. There are lots of issues, bias, injustice, and so on that come up, but I think these two basic categories are the kinds of things we need to be thinking about.
And again, to Nina, as you encountered AI in your MFA program, for instance, there were probably concerns that were raised in that process, or concerns that you've observed as a parent or as a consumer or a business person. What concerns are you aware of, and are we addressing those concerns as we make better or further use of AI?
I think As we move forward and there's an increasing amount of AI generated content, that the biggest danger, or this was my opinion maybe last week, that the biggest danger was a dilution of the human narrative. Because what happens is it becomes like self-referential. I think it was Jean Baudrillard, somebody can help me with the name. He talked about hyperreality. When instead of referring to the original, you refer to a reproduction. And so that, and the more we refer to the reproduction or the subsequent reproductions, the more diluted the original becomes. And so I think in my experience with artists is that that has been the biggest concern, because we lose the actual human to human connection or human to earth connection and the expression of that. And we are at our very elements. We are story. We are our own story. And so I think the big concern is the dilution of that and what that means for agency. Because if we have a default to what Gray was saying, to speed or production or efficiency, then we defer to this AI. We let the AI do the work for us. And then we just become proxy to it. And so we lose access to creative thinking skills. We lose access to our own drive. And so that is, I think, in the art community, probably at its core, the biggest issue.
Mm-hmm. And you used the word authenticity, I think, earlier in our conversation. That's connected to what you were just saying, I believe.
Yeah. So what is that? It's a one-to-one relationship, our experience with the earth and our experience with the people around us.
I remember hearing in the news sometime since the launch of ChatGPT, sometime in the last year, I think, about some individuals and institutions, about intellectual property concerns, about, I don't know if it was the New York Times or other large news outlets saying, hey, ChatGPT has been trained on our work. Let's talk about that. I don't remember where the legal chips have fallen, but it is interesting to think about the difference between me writing a news article and Nina reading it and learning from it in a human way versus a large language model learning from it. That's a very different use of the word learn.
We're going to turn to some of the potentials that each of you see, but I just want to remind listeners that they're tuned to Talk of the Towns. We're having a conversation about artificial intelligence in our lives. I've just heard from Nina Barafaldi St. Germain, who's a business owner, writer, and artist. Gray Cox is a professor of philosophy at College of the Atlantic and author of Smarter Planet or Wiser Earth. You just heard him define those two or kind of tease those two concepts out. And Greg Tehanapi, who is the Senior Director of Computational Sciences at the Jackson Lab. Liz, do you want to take up the next question?
Nina, I want to talk about visual art, because you know, maybe are more up on this than some of the rest of us. So there's my husband, who's also an artist, will periodically show me an image and explain why it's AI generated. And Greg talked about different AIs that are taking data from images and classifying them. So it's doing that work. But an AI that's generating or changing an image, I guess there's a famous image now of former President Trump praying in a church with the wrong number of fingers. And so that was what people pointed to. Oh, okay, that's clearly not a photograph because of that. And then this will get to what I think we want to talk more about too, about governments and AI, that something else I've heard Senator King talk a lot about is deep fakes. So I'm actually not quite clear on the connection between the role of AI in creating them, but the term deep fakes used to mean creating an audio or video recording of a person or what appears to be a specific person saying or doing something that they did not actually, the real life human did not actually say or do. So I wanted to throw that general topic to Nina for your thoughts on images and videos, and how is it, where are you excited and what are you concerned?
That's a huge question.
I know.
I'm trying to think about it. I think that I recently got an article, an AI written article, talking about how Bar Harbor was the one of top five beach destinations in New England. This is a curious thing, and it was clearly in my mind an AI written article. And then the same with the multiple fingers. You know, if you create an image, it can't get fingers right. There are certain things it just doesn't do well. It doesn't really get sarcasm or irony. That's another one it doesn't get. And so I think that it creates a distrust of and a healthy distrust, actually. So now I think when we start getting this information coming to us, we're like, what's happening here? And so we have to dig a little bit deeper. We can't trust everything we read on the internet, obviously, but we also can't trust everything we get from AI. And so in terms of the visual art and deep fakes, I think that the more involved in hyper reality we are, the less we will believe what we see for images.
Which is both
good and bad.
Gray, quickly, partly because I love it and wanted to highlight the fact that you flip through the first pages of your book and there's a table of contents and a list of images and a list of songs. Which is awesome. Super briefly about sound, you meant about uses of AI for sound, since we've touched on language and images. You said you mentioned bioacoustics or other examples of what AI is currently being used for.
In terms of positive uses of AI, there's a really fascinating book by Karen Baker, B-A-K-K-E-R, on called The Sounds of Life. And it's about bioacoustic research in the last 5 or 10 years. And she points out two major developments that are really transformative. One is the increasingly low cost and quality, high quality of recording devices that you can put in, out in the wild. You can leave a recorder for, 3 months in a bat cave and it'll track all kinds of data. And you can follow whales around in the Bering Straits. You can elephants, follow honeybees and so on, right? And so they're collecting all this data at the infrasound and ultrasound levels that we can't even hear, and finding things like, I never knew turtles communicate by sound, but it turns out that if you go to the Amazon River, there's a variety of turtle where the little turtles, when they're in their eggs, when one of them is ready to hatch, they sort of start making noise to let the others know, so they can all go to the beach together and try as a group to, maximize their survival rate. But when they get to the river, their mom's out there calling to them and leading them part of the river where there's good feed for them, right? So there's all this kind of communication that's being detected. But then the second thing that's happened recently is people are using large language models to decode all this data. And so they're starting to discover all kinds of things about the communications going on, and it turns out, for example, elephants, they have actually individual sound sequences. We'd call them proper names for each other to refer to individuals. And they have, a kind of word for honeybee. And it turns out that while elephants they're not afraid of Volkswagens, particularly, or M16s. But if you're a farmer in Kenya and you have a crop of corn and you want to keep the elephants away, you can just kind of tell them there are honeybees in this field and they will tend to steer clear, right? So what this is opening up in the realm of bioacoustics is really the opportunity for a kind of Google Translate for the animal kingdom, and not just the animal kingdom, because it turns out that flowers, for example, when they hear, I don't know how they hear, but the vibrations are somehow detected of honeybees approaching, and they increase their nectar. They release nectar and open up for the bees. So there's all this stuff going on in the world that we can understand better. And that, a lot of it is things that traditional cultures with traditional ecological knowledge have already at some level. People are learning from that. In Bering Strait, the Inuit who had been whaling there for hundreds of years would actually listen by sticking their paddle in the water and then listening through their jawbone and hear whales. This opens up really remarkable kinds of things we can be doing in agriculture and wildlife conservation, and just making the dialogue for a wiser Earth include all these other forms of intelligence that plants and animals provide.
That's a great, apologize, Ron, going off script a bit further. I putting my toddler in his car seat this morning, was thinking about training his natural intelligence and supporting it and cultivating it. Maybe it's a good way to think about it. Thinking about that all the way back to the beginning, philosophically about what is intelligence and how do we best benefit from it and how, what are useful ways to think about it. I wrote down when Greg said that some of his models have easy switches where you can tell it not to learn from this conversation, and boy, wouldn't that be nice with our children. So it's not a question, but as I know, we're getting close to beginning to wrap up, but I'm
we need another hour, I know. But Gray, could you talk a little bit about how you see AI helping with collaboration and perhaps the functions of government before we wrap up? Because I know that you've thought about that, you've written about that in your book. So tell us a little bit more about that, if you could.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are people who are working on this kind of thing. So if you're interested, there's a group in India that has a website called Socrates, Socrates.org. There's a group that originated in Spain called Consul. They've got a consuldemocracy.org. And in terms of working on issues like rape counseling and activism, there's a group called Project Callisto, Callisto.org. Those are just examples of the folks who are trying to take this idea of dialogical kinds of reasoning, where you want to include all the voices and all the values in dialogue. And learn in the last 50, 60 years, there's been a lot of research on how to do mediation, conflict resolution, win-win negotiation, group problem solving, conflict transformation, peacemaking, a lot of substantive research. Unfortunately, most of the folks who are leading company work in AI are trained in STEM. And so they tend to think in terms of reasoning that is exemplified by mathematics, engineering, and is based in monological linear inference, that's what rationality is. And so, I mean, a lot of them are really good at dialogical reasoning and negotiation, but that's not their explicit image of it. We need to make that dialogical conception the explicit image of the reasoning we use whenever we're working with values, so we can be inclusive. And we can draw on all these rich traditions that also include indigenous communities around the world with traditions of elders' councils and so on. And there's even in the best forms of traditional New England town meetings, there are traditions that are very useful to learn from. And there are also ones to sort of try to avoid, you know. But we've got to be drawing on that to collaborate in the design of the AI systems and the social system. That's my basic wrap. A lot more to say about it.
Yeah, I just had a thought, and I apologize. It's kind of all the way on the far other spectrum of the kinds of things we've been pondering, but it's a specific question that I'm very curious about Greg's answer to. With existing and I'm assuming somewhat growing use of AI in your day job at Jax, has it impacted? So I was just looking at your title of computational sciences, and I'm curious about one of the things that also periodically comes up in the news is computational power and the servers themselves and the computers themselves and the energy and other inputs that are needed to create these outputs that we've been discussing. And how's that conversation going at Jax or that you're aware of elsewhere?
So yes, it's going in a lot of places. At Jax, there's a continual need for computing power over the last several decades. And there's something called Moore's Law, which talks about the rate at which transistor density increases over time, doubles, or like every 18 months or something along those lines. And frankly, that growth in computing power is in part what is powering this new wave of large language models and capabilities, because the compute power to handle the billions and billions of pieces of data that are required to train them wasn't available not very long ago. It also does consume huge amounts of power and money. It costs $100 million to $1 billion to train one of these models. So it's a very expensive activity. Where is it going? We're trying to stay in pace with that line of growth. One of the wild cards here is quantum computing. Which is using quantum physics to do calculations. It's still a very nascent field, but has the potential to absolutely dwarf the advances of traditional computing. And so, if that comes to pass, it's almost impossible to predict what that could potentially mean for AI. For it would reduce power needs, but it would. It potentially could also solve problems that today aren't even vaguely comprehensible to be solved. At least that's my understanding.
Gray, you wanted to make the pitch about how we help schools deal with this as they interact with students?
Yeah, thanks, Ron. I've been talking with the people in local schools, teachers in local schools about AI, and I've done some workshops in schools and with kids and stuff. You know, people are really aware of all the stuff going on and the novelty of it and the importance of coping with it and the fact that their students are using it and they can misuse it or use it for good. And the problem is that, as we know, teachers are overworked, right? And so in the conversation, sort of a strategy conversation with some folks about, well, so what can we do? One of the teachers who's in a kind of leadership role in this stuff said, well, maybe we could have like a 2-hour workshop in September and then do something in the winter. And I thought, you know, that's just not going to cut it. This stuff is blowing our minds every week with what's happening, right? We got to create the time and money and support for teachers to have, you know, for at least for some lead teachers who can be finding our way with this, to have like an afternoon a week just to learn what's going on and to think about how to adapt it to our system. And also maybe to start thinking about how we have to adapt our system to it. Mm. You know, so I would encourage all the listeners out there to be thinking about contacting your school board, talking with your principals, talking with your neighbors about, you know, funding our way into the future, because this is going to be a major part of it. And if we don't do something to get ready, our kids are going to be left behind.
Greg, thoughts from you about where we go from here briefly? What gives you hope?
Well, I've been reading a book called The Coming Wave by Mustafa Suleiman. Actually, I finished it. He is the co-founder of DeepMind, and which the system that produced some amazing breakthroughs in artificial intelligence. This book is a New York Times bestseller, and it's somehow fascinating and terrifying at the same time. He talks about this AI, energy, quantum computing, robotics, nanotechnologies, you know, coming together and the potential impacts in the next 10 to 30 years. And you know, thinking, I read Gray's book with quite interest too, after having listened to that. And so I would say, if you want to think about more, you know, the real incredible range of what could happen, that's an interesting read.
And Nina, final word to you. What gives you hope? Do you have some resources? Help us wrap up.
Oh, okay. Well, I think I woke up this morning and I was thinking about AI and our conversation, and I was thinking about the foundations of language and how, you know, it's meant to grow. Our language is meant to grow. It started with sounds, and then sounds became words, perhaps nouns, perhaps verbs, you know, these parts of speech, and then the parts of speech combined to become, you know, I want, she has, dog, right? All of these things. And so then the sentence becomes a story, right? Maybe simplified story. But then I started thinking about this amazing computational power, and that, you know, we're so conditioned to thinking that language is somewhat static, that this is our language. And I was thinking perhaps there is something beyond story that we are arriving at, and that there is a much larger kind of cosmic story that we can come into with our combined languages that AI will help us see. So that's maybe speaks to the singularity. But it was just a fun train of thought to follow this morning.
Mm. Well, we've just scratched the surface in this hour, but we have come to the end of the hour. And I want to remind listeners to join us from 4 to 5 on the second Wednesday afternoon of each month for Talk of the Towns. And podcasts of this program and others can be found in the archive section of the WERU website. Our theme music is a medley from Karanak on a Balmain House Highland Music Recording. Thanks again to our guests, Gray Cox, a professor of philosophy at College of the Atlantic and author of Smarter Planet or Wiser Earth. Nina Barapaldi St. Germain is a business owner, writer, and artist. And Greg Tehennepi is the senior director of computational sciences at the Jackson Laboratory. Thanks to our underwriters. Thanks to Joel Mann for engineering our program. And stay tuned for Ralph Nader Radio from 5 to 6 and The Group Shop from 6 to 8. Liz Graves and I are producers and hosts for Talk of the Towns. And this is Ron Beard wishing you a good afternoon.